Hello, friends. This is Eric, and welcome to Anti-Visions. Well, friends, we've come to the end of season one of Anti-Visions, and I'm not really sure when I'm going to pick up with season two. Honestly, I think I'm going to take a break from podcasting just for a little while. There's just so much noise going on, and I think I need to step back and just really think about it. I feel like a lot of the things that I wanted to share and get out, I got to share, and there's a lot more that's on my mind and a lot more that could be said about the subjects and topics that I spoke about. But I could be a few weeks, it could be a month, it could be a year. I don't know how long I'll take a break or if I'll even come back to Anti-Visions at all. But I'm just going to, you know, give a closeout session here and share some of my thoughts, some of my wrap-up thoughts on a few different major topics that I've hit on. One, of course, would be critical race theory, especially as it relates to the church. And I know briefly I'm going to say something about the elections, as I had a short pod, or it wasn't a short podcast, but a podcast last time. But I'll briefly say something about that as well. As I know, as of this recording, it's still, the fiasco is still going on. And also a little bit, there's some other things that I want to say about media and just the culture wars in general. As it relates to critical race theory, and particularly the church, I know that many of my podcasts have been just about the theory in general and the broader critical theory, postmodern deconstructionism, just the broader context of critical race theory. But when it comes down to it, what really, in my world, really affects me and affects my heart is the effect that it's having on the church. And this can't be said about the whole church, but definitely segments or streams of the church that I know or that I follow and that I know influence a lot of my friends and have a lot of impact in culture. And I've been really saddened to see some of the conversation that's going on. I don't think that there's any ill will or ill intention in it. I really don't have any need to try to figure out what the true motivation is. I'm just saddened by the discussion, because it sort of takes the form of just what you're hearing in general, which is, you know, we want to have a conversation, we want to listen. Well, that's good, we want to listen. But it's going to be a one-sided conversation. And if you question the narrative, then you're going to be looked at with suspicion. Now, of course, in the Christian world, you're not going to be just flat out called a racist or a bigot. It's not going to get as vitriolic, at least initially, as it would in the world, but there's still a suspicion that's cast upon you if you don't agree with white privilege, systemic racism, and all of these things, as though, as I've said many times, as though to deny those things is to deny racism. Those are not equivalent. You don't have to embrace critical race theory to believe that there are social and racial issues at hand that need solutions. It just so happens that I believe that critical race theory is the absolute wrong direction to go, that it will only increase the very problems it claims to fix, that it's going to inject racism into this next generation more than the past generation has seen. And it's all in the name of solving a problem that I think these problems do need to be solved. So it's saddening to me when I listen to podcasts. I've listened to several from different streams that a lot of people listen to. And, you know, they're having these conversations and it's all the same stuff that I read that that's outside of the church. They're referring to the same books. They're using the same statistics, using the same language, the same everything. It's what everybody is saying. There's nothing countercultural about it all. Not that the church has to be countercultural just for the sake of it. And of course, I'm not going to enumerate again so many of my reasons why I think there are good reasons to question critical race theory and its conclusions, because I've already stated many of them. There's a lot more to be said there, and there's so much on both sides of the equation. Most of all, I think that is what's important, is that there are two sides. I don't like it when there's something that is maybe controversial, it's a really big deal, it's a hot topic, and only one side is allowed to be honored and even spoken. And the other side, the whole goal is just to squash it, to tell people, no, there's nothing there, look away, don't think that at all, you're wrong. If you think that, you're a racist, you think that, you're a bigot, or whatever the accusation might be. Because, you know, in the church, we're notorious for this stuff, not calling each other racist and bigots, but we're notorious for, you know, if you're a Calvinist, you don't want to listen to the Arminian. If you're Arminian, you don't want to listen to the Calvinist. If you believe this about baptism, then you don't want to hear what the other person says about baptism. And I mean, we have our theological debates, and eschatology is a huge one, you know, the theories of the end times. I think that anything that's a really hot topic, that's very difficult, more than one side needs to be heard and honored. And that, when you're talking about theology, I'm talking about within the bounds of doctrine, within the boundaries of you know, accepted orthodox doctrine. But we have a tendency to do that. But it's not just a tendency in the church, it's a tendency in humanity for us to just, even if we're not religious or don't believe in God at all, to kind of pick our side, and we don't want the other side to be heard. Well, I stand in a place where I like to understand the other side, and you know, even if I already know what I think, but one, I want to challenge what I think, because I think that's important. If we get in an echo chamber and we don't listen to anything outside of it, we become unaccountable and can very well start developing dumber and dumber ideas without ever being challenged. So even for someone who is confident in what they believe, it is in their best interest to be in a position to always have some kind of challenge. I always want to check myself. And I think that if we're confident in what we believe, we should not fear being challenged. So I understand that it's a little bit different when you're talking about racism. But the reality is that most of the things that are being discussed are matters of opinion, and they're also matters of interpreting facts and data. So there is room to debate without accusing one another of being a racist or being insensitive or being tone deaf. But alas, I don't want to just rail on and on about it. I will say that one of the things that time and again really, because I was just listening to another podcast through a group in the Gospel Coalition, and I was struck by, I mean, the tenor of the conversation was really good. Of course, there's no challenge or dissent within it. But what strikes me over and over is that there is this assumption that we are in the midst of this great, I wouldn't say revolution, but this great new civil rights movement, you know, the greatest of our time since Martin Luther King. And I remember Rasul Berry listening to him, and he said something very similar. And here we are, and the church is, you know, tending to do the same thing that back in the civil rights, you know, to sit on the sidelines and to be on the wrong side of history. Well, I don't want to open that can of worms. I guess I just did. But what I see, though, that's so very different is that today's rhetoric, today's argument doesn't have an end goal. I still have yet to hear any defined end goal. When you're talking about Martin Luther King and the civil rights, Martin Luther King wanted equality. What they wanted was to be treated by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. Well, that's honestly, I've heard many proponents of critical race theory actually say that they don't like that very phrase because they feel that it gets misused. Nonetheless, that's what Martin Luther King Jr. wanted. They wanted to be able to go to the same schools, drink from the same water fountains, sit anywhere they want on the bus, to be able to work in the same places, you know, wanted to be treated equally. And there were real laws that were in the way. Today, I don't hear of any laws that are in the way. There are no, you know, maybe you know of some obscure thing that, you know, people could debate about, but overall, what is the end goal here? You know, what can be done? Because they were fighting, they had an objective. It was very clear, you know, we're going to reach this point and this is what we're going for. Right now, nothing is defined. It's just, we just want to endlessly accuse white people and the West of being terrible. And what is the end goal of this? Is it going to produce something better or something worse? I mean, there's a difference. Even when you think about in the Bible, there's a difference between being, you know, Israel being delivered out of Egypt. God delivered them out of slavery, delivered them out of Egypt. It was his work. It was an intervention. That's one thing. But when they were going to go into Canaan, into the promised land, they had to cross that river themselves. God didn't part that river. They had to step into it. They had to cross over. They had to pick up their swords, their shields, and they had to actually fight. They had to work. The manna from heaven stopped, and the message was, I will deliver you out of your bondage, but if you want your inheritance, you have to fight and you have to work for it. So I feel that that's where we're at, is there's this place where, okay, moving forward, how do you take the ground? There's not manna from heaven. It's not going to drop anymore. It's not going to fall and just fall into our lap, you know? I mean, what's the goal? The only stated goal I can hear is maybe reparations. Even that, you know, I'm not going to argue for or against it as of this moment, but just consider if there was a payout, if it was a financial, you know, hey, this will solve the problem. We're just going to pay out. Every African-American gets a certain amount of money every month or every year until so many years. And I've heard different figures. Well, let's just say even, gosh, I mean, I'm thinking, God, if that would work, that'd be nice. Aside from the fact that we don't have the money to do that, but whatever, maybe we'll just print more money. My point is that even if we had the money and even if it was okay, would the next generation say, hey, I can't believe you sold us so short? If there's still a struggle, would the next generation say, well, that's not enough. We still want more. I mean, where does the line end? And what role does the church have in this? Are we helping this along, or are we helping bring reconciliation and forgiveness into a place where there really is an absolute dead end apart from the cross of Jesus Christ, apart from the place where you might be right, you might be wrong, you might be a sinner, you might be a saint, it doesn't matter. No one's getting beyond this offense without the cross and the resurrection. So, you know, I could go on and on with that, but I think that's one of my appeals to you, is to ask yourself, where is this going? You know, what's the defined goal? What are we after here? Because in the past there were defined goals, but now I don't hear them. And the ones that I hear way off in the distance, and it's not coming through the church, I really don't agree with. I think that a lot of what's happening right now is the church is getting caught up in something that's way bigger than race, and we're massively distracted. And I know that would offend a lot of people because racism is real. And the struggles that people have had with oppression is real. I am not denying that reality. I'm just saying that there's something really big going on, and we think that this is the big issue, and it's not. That's just my opinion. And, you know, hopefully, if you don't agree with my opinion, you can handle the fact that my opinion is my opinion, and that it's not hateful. Even if it is, I should still be allowed to say it, but it's not, and we should be okay with that. If we want our opinion to be honored, our speech to be honored, our thoughts to be honored. We have to honor other people as well, even the ones we disagree with. Because if you take away someone else's right to have their opinion or to say what they think, then the same rights will be non-existent for you. They will not be there for you when you need them to protect you. Finally, I'm going to wrap up this segment of the conversation about the church with something that I've hesitated to share before, but I'm just going to share it. Is a few months ago, I was listening, of course, to another debate, and this one was one, these are my least favorite, is one where it's the church. I like listening to the debates. Generally, I'm spending more time listening and reading authors and speakers who are not they're not purporting to be part of the church or anything. It's just a social cultural conversation. But this was one of those conversations where they were all Christians and discussing, you know, how they need to decolonize their theology and decolonize their library, and this whole discussion was just going on. And I just couldn't help. I had this moment. I remember I was walking my dog, and I had this moment where I couldn't help but feel almost all of a sudden like when remembering, not that I was there, but that on the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution, as Russia's future and fate was about to dramatically change, the clergy of, I believe, probably the Orthodox Church, because that's, you know, Eastern Orthodox, they were in hot debate. I mean, it was a deep and hot debate that had been going on even all the way up to the eve, that behind those closed doors, inside those walls of that church and those churches, they were debating something you wouldn't imagine. It is far more important than the possibility of a Bolshevik revolution that was going to overthrow the entire church system that they know and the freedom of all of these people, and that would eventually produce tens of millions of dead bodies. They were debating on the color of their garments, of their vestments, you know, the whatever, the robes and stuff that they wear. They were debating on the colors of these things. On the eve of a revolution where heads were about to roll. Now, did they know that that was about to happen? No. But I just couldn't help but think, I feel like that is the danger the church is in right now. That we are debating intensely about something that seems so utterly important. Now, I know this is the offensive part because we know, of course, how trite that they were arguing about vestments and garments. But the reason why this slammed into my mind was because as I was listening to their discussion, about especially decolonizing their theology, I couldn't help but see through the fact that, you know, theology is theology. Yeah, you could go back and you can find different theologians and different time periods in history that did have racial views, or particularly the Puritans and different ones that, because of the West and colonialism and different things, you can find things that they thought that were offensive to us about either indigenous peoples or African Americans, just depending on where they lived. They were people of their time. But when they wrote theology per se, there's still good theology. You don't get rid of a theology book just because you didn't like what they thought about a certain colored person. Now, if the theology is trying to teach you to believe a certain thing about a certain group of people, like the whole idea of Cain and I think it's Cain or Ham and the color of skin and all of that, that's debunked. That's been proven where it comes from, and that's a whole other story. But I couldn't help but feel that in their conversations, there was this similar kind of debate going on, where there's this debate over the color of our garments. You know, within the church, I don't think that God asks us to be colorblind in the sense that we pretend that there's no black and there's no white. He doesn't ask us to pretend that there's no man, there's no woman, even though Paul says there's neither, you know, male nor female, there's neither Jew nor Greek. Basically, there's not neither black nor white. But he's not saying that they don't exist. He's just saying that we still, in the eyes of God, we still are equal. We treat one another equally. Okay, so here we are debating about melanin, and there's a revolution on the outside. And I think that, honestly, there's so much, it's to me, it's obvious. There's so much division and dissension in our culture, in the culture wars, in politics, in everything. There's just polarization. And within the church, we're falling for it. We're starting to fight amongst each other in a time where there's been more racial progress than ever. And now we're starting to divide over it. Do we need some major racial reconciliation in the church? Absolutely. But critical race theory is going to take us in the absolute wrong direction. Okay, now on to my next topic, the elections. I know my last podcast, I shared just a little response to John Piper. It was really off the cuff. And then I rambled on about why I thought it's important in this election and why I would vote for someone like Donald Trump, because to me it's not really about him, but I am concerned about the corruption and about, you know, certain things that if you go back and you listen to it. Well, I want to just follow up with, I know even right now as of this recording, we still don't know who won. There's a lot of anger towards Trump because he hasn't conceded, and yet President-elect Biden is not actually technically president-elect. There's possible, we know that there obviously were miscounts. We know that there were, lots of ballots from, you know, dead people that voted. And so there are obviously things that were fraudulent. Now, whether there's like this widespread sort of overarching scheme of fraud and whether it's enough to actually overturn the election, we don't know. But it is something that constitutionally Trump can have his day in court. I just hope that if it is proven that it's not true, like as in the courts decide against Trump, that at that point he will be open and unlike his character, that he would be very clear with the people that he accepts that, because I'm concerned for all, you know, those that stand for Trump, that many of them will not accept those results. And I stand in a position where I know many say, well, there's corruption. I look at it like, well, there very well could be. And I don't doubt, you know, looking back at the Russia probe and looking at what happened with General Flynn and with the deep state, there are a lot of things that have been uncovered that are really concerning to me. And I want those things to be exposed. And that's why I think in this situation, it's okay to go to court. Because we have a process for this. The Constitution allows for this, and there will be resolution. And so if there's resolution in the courts, we should be able to accept it. I can accept it. If the courts rule and say, no, there's not corruption here, then I can accept that. Because I believe that our system still works. Are there some corrupt judges? Sure. Is there, you know, are there problems in the deep state? Sure. But overall, I think our results work. That's why I wasn't okay with, you know, the way that the attorney general for Breonna Taylor's case was treated. You know, this idea that these grand juries can't be trusted. I mean, we have to trust our system and understand that overall, especially with this many court cases, if it's decided and it's, and it's dismissed, then we should accept that, and it would be really important. But I think that the other side needs to understand that that is a valuable thing, because corruption doesn't help the right or the left. So, you know, at the end of the day, as a Christian, I look at it and I say, well, I know how I voted, and I shared last time why on my conscience I voted a certain way, and I think that people could honestly vote with their conscience either way and God not strike them down and be mad at them, you know, if they're a believer, you vote your conscience. But in the end, I do believe that whichever way, you know, as a Christian, I think it's a mistake. Like, say Trump, you know, it's proven. There's not widespread fraud. It doesn't overturn the election. The courts rule, even from the Supreme Court, it pans out and Biden is our president. I believe every Christian should accept that and recognize that, you know, the Lord is still reigning and ruling on his throne. And you know, he's not limited. It's not like he's going, oh my gosh, I just didn't foresee this. Now everything is going to fall apart. Well, there will be some really difficult things coming our way. But at that point, we have to accept it as the will of God and accept that not everything always goes our way. And that's not unheard of. I mean, there are times that trial and difficulties come upon people. And if there are, you know, trying days ahead because of who's in the presidency, but we've exhausted all that we can do. Nobody can trump God. Trump can be Trump, but he can't trump God. So I just look at it like that. And I hope that those who are, you know, especially on the right, will accept the results. And, you know, I know that so many on the left, you know, already feel that it's ridiculous that we're pushing through this process. But we have to realize that even if there was widespread corruption, I think so many people on the left will see that in itself as corruption and won't accept it. So, you know, that's what I think about the elections, but I'll continue on with that polarization. So it's this place where no longer can we communicate. No longer do we understand each other. There's half of the population thinks the other half is crazy. Whether it's the right or the left, there are so many that say, you know, I can't even understand them anymore. It's like we've become unintelligible, mutually unintelligible. And this is a dangerous place to be, regardless of what you think about Biden or Trump or whether you're right or the left. When we reach a point as a nation where we can't communicate, we don't hear one another, and we literally are disgusted with one another because we're so convinced that we're right, something is wrong. And I think it's that bigger something that plays into these elections. And I think it's the same bigger something that plays even into the church and critical race theory. And this, there is this division that's going on. Critical race theory and the social justice issues have been extremely divisive in our nation, and politics has been divisive. And it just seems to me that it's all a symptom of a bigger problem. Now, what that problem is, I don't completely know, but I have some ideas. I have come to believe that we have moved beyond the culture wars. In some ways, I would say the culture wars are over, they're dead. Because we have moved into the reality wars. This is literally a battle for reality. And a great place to see it is obviously political, that on the left and the right both have a completely, not just different visions, like anti-visions, but even a completely different perception of reality itself. And a lot of that has to do with social media and media in general. So, you know, like if you're on the right, you know that there are a lot of things that you think are really important and newsworthy that don't even get reported at all on the left. And that is a constant problem. It really is. So there are these two realities on both sides, right? And especially when it comes to social media and algorithms that feed based on what you like and what you listen to, then it creates these echo chambers, whether it's on the right or the left. And you will tend to not be confronted with or be exposed to what maybe is coming out on the other side, which can create a skewed sense of reality, especially if you're not being exposed to something that's actually true. And I think that I think that there's probably more than just, you know, two sides. I think there are multiple, it's like a multiverse of maybe it's not that much, but I think there are multiple different realities. There's probably super extreme left realities, super extreme right realities. And then there are, you know, left realities that are probably still, you know, pretty intense and just like the right. But for sure, when it comes to media, I would say that all of the news networks, you know, Fox News is the only one that's kind of a big network that will report conservative news, and still there are things that they don't touch, and still things that, you know, I'm not like a Fox News guy all the way, but they're the only ones. If you listen to ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, all these different news networks, they're owned and funded by the same entertainment companies, the same billionaires, and they all say the same thing, and they all choose to not report the same thing. They will repeat the same lies. Not that there aren't lies on the right either, but they repeat the same things, and it creates a people that are not getting journalism. We're not getting the truth. Truth is dead. I mean, there's no journalism is supposed to be about reporting the facts and the truth. But now we just have people who pontificate their opinions, and they don't care about the truth. They don't care about the facts. They care about their agenda. And there is no way for me or for you that I know of to access so many of these facts, right? When you're trusting the media, you're trusting that they're telling you as objectively as they can, the facts of what so-and-so said or didn't say, or what happened, you know, or what the documents said, or whatever that might be. But now we don't have that anymore. So it can create, even whether you're on the right or the left, I mean, I definitely have that sense of, gosh, how do you know what is true? You know, how can you really know? How can you be convinced? I mean, I do see a lot of censorship. My eyes have been opened, and as especially as the election has drawn near, I used to really, honestly, there was a good while these past several years, really since the last election, it was such a circus that I really have not paid that much attention to news and social media, just not really at all the past 4 years. If you look back on my accounts and I just stayed away from that. Obviously I'm a thinker, I'm a reader, but I just stayed away from all that social mambo jambo. And I find, as I've come back and as I've been, you know, dealing with some of these culture war issues, started Anti-Visions, been reading, listening to the news, paying attention to Twitter, listening to a lot of independent journalists that I trust more than the mainstream media. And I have been blown away by how much censorship there is. I did not know, but, and many people on the left probably don't know how many people on the right get censored. Like where their tweets, their accounts, their YouTube videos get censored. And it's all in the name of, well, you guys are right-wing extremists. Well, the social media, everything on the right to them, and I'm not exaggerating, everything on the right is radical, okay? So there is no voice on the right that they want to be allowed. Now, you can still say things out there, but you would not believe how many people have been banned who are not radical, they're not dangerous. You would not believe how many people, even that I've followed, where they've been locked out. And then it was so obvious, and I know half the population doesn't even know this, but the New York Post, as I referenced in my last podcast, was locked out of their account for 13 days because of an article that was reporting facts. It was an article about facts, but it did not fit the narrative. Twitter locked them, and everybody who retweeted it was locked out too. Even the White House's press secretary was locked out of the account, of their account. New York Post locked out of their account. Major politicians, people that retweeted this story, were locked out. And the New York Post is the oldest newspaper in the United States, 200 years old. It definitely has a reputation. It's a reputable, let's say, news source. It's not like, you know, inquiring minds want to know, right? So that's blatant and brazen. And when you drag Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, and now already yesterday they did another hearing with them, these guys will lie through their teeth. They will lie through their teeth and they don't care. And this is where I'm really concerned. Politics matter. They do matter. But there's something way bigger going on than just politics. Okay, we have moved on in our society, and there is power at play that is far beyond yesterday's politics. And too many of us, I think, are looking backwards. And I think that, you know, it's important to understand history and also to protect history. But we're also imagining that everything is always going to be the way that it was. And I think that's a major mistake. We are on the brink of a civilizational shift that's far more dramatic than the Industrial Revolution ever saw. And we are right in the middle of it, and it's going to go way faster because everything is exponential with technology and whatnot. And I think that we just can't imagine what's taking place. And just realizing that, you know, these social media, especially like Google, so wealthy. They have Facebook, Google. They have far more money than our government does, or than multiple countries put together, and they have far more power. You know, and some people say, well, you know, the Democrats are in bed, and it's true. The Democrats have been in bed, especially going back to the Obama administration. I'm not making it up, particularly with Google, but with big tech. But it's not Democratic leaders that control big tech. They're not the ones that are going to call the shots. They're owned by big tech. Friends, there is a reality war going on. And I don't know, I'm not even going to pretend to know what all the agendas are, but I have a really good hunch it has a lot to do with money. Now, what the bigger vision is, I don't know. Is it the Great Reset, the World Economic Forum's Great Reset? If you're not familiar with that, you should look it up. I mean, you know, some people would say you're a conspiracy theorist, but every major bank, every major technology company, Google, Twitter, Facebook, you name it, every major politician from all around the world, they're part of the World Economic Forum, and they have a vision for the world, okay? But aside from that, I believe that even if they try to accomplish their Great Reset vision of the world, that the end goal for them is money. There is so much money to be made in politics. This is capitalism that has gone out of control. And you know, I am no Marxist. Absolutely not. But capitalism has gone unchecked. It's gone out of control. Capitalism only really works. It's not perfect. It only works when there are honest people, when greed is put in check, and when the right things are held accountable. And the Republicans are just as guilty. And now Republicans and the right are the ones that get censored, but are just as responsible, especially Republican politicians are just as responsible, even though they're outraged about being censored, because they equally, if not more, wanted to allow everything to be absolute free market. And these big tech companies, especially since the year 2000, this has all happened only since the year 2000. I think Google really had their massive watershed breakthrough in the way they collect data in 2002. So it's not that long ago that this was all happening. Nobody could have foreseen where technology would go. Not even Google or Facebook. None of them knew the monster that they were going to create. So I don't think these were intentional things. And I understand the Republican idea is typically free market. You know, we don't want to limit. And then there's the concern of free speech, and we don't want to limit free speech on the internet, whatnot. But whatever it is, everybody's just as guilty, okay? You can debate about it all day long, but all the while, particularly Google, got to go unchecked. I'm not just making this up. I've read, there's a book called Surveillance Capitalism by a woman named, she's a Harvard professor, Shoshana Zuboff. She's, you know, in her book, her politics don't really come through, but I've looked her up and, you know, politically she's on the left. She's all Biden all the way, but you read this, but it's like a 500 page book, a little more than 500 pages, and then it's over 600 pages, almost 700 pages with the index and all of that. And it is intense. It's like, it's brilliantly written, but it's about the fight for a human future at the new frontier of power. And she calls it the age of surveillance capitalism. And that's what we've moved into. We've moved out of capitalism as we knew it and into a time of what you could call surveillance capitalism. And basically, if you don't know what that is, Google is really the brainchild of all of this. But all of this was able to happen because they were not regulated, and most of it happened in secrecy. But they, of course, are, you know, the masters of the search engine. Well, long ago, they discovered, hey, the best thing we could do is start taking all of this residual data, you know, that everybody thinks is just a waste. So it's, you know, the interactions and everything that happens on the internet, that everything that you might have done, your habits of buying and selling and all of this stuff. And they just collected data and collected data and collected data. And it turned out that it was almost like this revelatory discovery in 2002, where this incident happened and they were able to use the data and then look at world events and interpret very specifically what went on and why. And they began to realize that with all of this data that we collect that seems to be, you know, unnecessary, it's like I said, it's sort of like the exhaust fumes. It's the trail of, you know, what was your search history? How long did you look at an image? What have you purchased? What did you buy? Where places you travel? What kind of people do you talk to? What kind of books do you read? You know, every little bit of data. So basically, they realize the value in it is that they can actually make predictions about us. And they didn't really realize that, but there was this revelation that, you know, if we can extract as much data as possible from people, then we can understand people more, and then we can predict what they're going to do. And because of that, we can predict what they want, what they desire, and we can make way more money. Because, you know, what advertiser, what huge corporation, what huge business doesn't want to use somebody like Google, who can offer very focused, laser focused advertising? Instead of throwing, you know, millions of dollars to the wind, you could give it to Google and they can pinpoint those advertisements specifically for the right person at the right time, so that person is most likely to respond. So they learned this. So they moved from the vision of making information available to the world, which was their vision, and they had a vision of not using advertising and actually they used to say, don't be evil. They moved from that to a place where, for certain reasons, particularly financial crisis and things like that, they kind of suspended their you know, belief system and their social agreement, in a sense, with their users, and started using us. And we're not the product so much, but there, you know, Google is not a product. Google Sheets, Google, you know, I use the whole Google Suite, Google Docs, Google, you know, they have all these amazing tools, right? And they're all free, but that is not their product. Okay. But also, we are not their customers. We used to be, like, early on, that's how they viewed us. And early on, they were out to sell products. But that all changed when they realized that they could extract so much data. And they're not interested in selling that information. But you have to understand that they have they probably know more about you and me than we know about ourselves, because it's all within a network, almost like a neural network, right? Like this network where your identity, your history, your every digital movement that they can extract is all put together. And so there's constant predictions. And then there are these algorithms that are always constantly trying to feed you to get you to click on the next thing, to get you to do this and to do that, because it's predictive. And so that is what they sell, because their customer is not us. Their customer are those advertisers who give them lots of money. So this is about money, obviously. It's a business. But what they're selling isn't even information about us. What they're selling is predictions about us. Google is jealous for their information. As a matter of fact, they have made sure that they all the more secure the surplus of information that nobody else would have access to it. So they don't have interest in necessarily in selling information about us, but they do have a really scary relationship with the government going back to the Obama administration that makes it very eerie. There, I could go on with this on and on, but I think maybe you'll realize that as I'm sharing these things, that my perception is that there's far more going on in our society than just a debate about race. And, you know, why is it that in a time where, you know, our society was prospering more, when black people were much higher in employment, where overall everyone was prospering more, it's not like it was perfect, all of a sudden we're tearing each other apart? Well, you got COVID. Well, that's one of the things. And I'll tell you, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I do know that COVID is being used as an opportunity by the World Economic Forum, and they are very open about that. I'm not saying that they caused it. I'm just saying that they're very open that it is an opportunity for them to actually carry out their plans for the globe. So going back even to Google, I know I was in the middle of a little story there, and basically it's gone to a place, I just want to finish that out, that not only do they harbor all this data about us, all of the companies that they have, you know, over the years, and Facebook is in the same business. They just don't, they're not as big as Google, but they have their cookies, they have their sensors, they have their way of, any time you download one of their products or it's even somewhere on your phone, they're constantly collecting data about you. Because Mark Zuckerberg also, he's said before, he wants to know every movie you've ever seen, every book you've ever read. I mean, they want to know our soul. They want to know what we think, what we believe, so they can predict it, so they can make more money, and they want to expand those markets. So the market is not just a product out there where, you know, you make more stuff and manufacture more stuff. The market, the frontier is, in a way, it's in our soul. And they want to go deeper and deeper into that place so that they can understand more and grow the power of prediction, right? So that they can expand, you know, the market, the economy. That's the way, you know, there's always a demand for more. You gotta have a bigger margin and make more money and more profits. And you know, and then on the same note, they're highly like exploratory, and there's the creativity aspect. And at this point, they don't answer to anybody anymore. So they have ridiculous power. But now they've moved into, which was always the vision from early on, into a place where it's not just predictions. They are actually modifying our behavior. It's cognitive behavior modification. And I'm not making it up. I mean, they're very clear. Some of the biggest thinkers are behind this. I can't remember one of the guy's name. It begins with a P something. And it's amazing, but they have the vision and actually do it. It's not just like a future thing, but they want it to be even more so future. Right now, it's mostly been for commercial purposes, but it's not just predicting what you like. You know, oh, they'll like this picture over that picture. Throw up an advertisement right now. You know, the algorithm knows that, like, right now at this moment, you're at this time, and the chances are, if you see this post or if you see this particular commercial, you're going to respond to it. So they're predicting what are you most likely to follow versus, you know, just going ahead and click your phone off, turn it off and stick it in your pocket because you're bored or something. How many times were you going to get off Facebook or going to get off of whatever it was, YouTube, but there was something else that popped up right at that moment and you say you followed that trail? That is the result of those algorithms that I'm talking about. And that is the power of prediction. And every time they keep you on, they're making more money. Every time they have you viewing it, they talk about this in detail in a movie called The Social Dilemma. You can only get it on Netflix. But that movie is only scratching the surface of this stuff. That lady I mentioned, Shoshana, she's interviewed in it for a couple of seconds, and she's talking about how anti-democratic this surveillance capitalism really is. So, you know, they're at a point where, you know, now we're not just trying to predict, we are actually modifying your behavior, training you to actually like certain things or, you know, go down certain paths and choose certain things. Obviously, it's small behavior modification over time. Well, what happens when that behavior modification isn't just about selling you a product, but it's about selling you an ideology? It's about selling you a particular political stance or particular worldview. It reminds me of Winston Churchill once said, you know, supposedly he's a bigot, but Winston Churchill once said a long time ago that the future empires will not be, you know, the empires that we've known, but they will be empires of the mind. And right now, these big tech companies are building a completely entirely new empire. And they have a completely different vision than we do. And I am not trying to push conspiracy theories, because part of it is just simply a reality war. If people can't understand one another, more and more we have riots, and we actually risk something like civil war, which has happened in the Philippines and Myanmar and other places where countries destabilize because they can no longer communicate. I'm not saying that somebody has the plan to do that, but they could. And certainly big tech has the power for that. And if we don't recognize that, even within the church, whether we're debating about race or in our country, we're debating about race and politics and just at each other's throats, you know, I don't know if there's a motivation to separate us, if it's just a residual effect of living in these sort of virtual realities, and now we don't know what's real anymore, or if there really is an intention to divide and separate us. All the while, there are people who are gaining and garnering power. And so, you know, with that said, going back to surveillance capitalism, as I mentioned that Ms. Zuboff, or if that's how you say her name, said that it's actually highly anti-democratic. So, you know, in a way, it's a misnomer to call it surveillance capitalism, because we have moved out of capitalism. Friends, we are, this isn't about, you know, trying to get back. And I think even it's a mistake for those that are on the right that are conservative to keep, you know, it's like they think that we're still in this place where we're trying to defend free markets. And they've failed to realize that we are no longer in that form of capitalism anymore. You try to use F.A. Hayek's, you know, solutions, and even I love, you know, Thomas Sowell. You try to use their solutions and it doesn't work, because we've begun to move into something that really, in my opinion, isn't really capitalism at all anymore. You know, maybe oligarchy or something, you know, but what's happening is power is beginning to consolidate with these groups of people, and they're beginning to control society and manipulate society. And they are in league with the World Economic Forum. Klaus Schwab is the leader of that. They meet at Davos in Switzerland every year. It's been going on, you know, a bunch of just kind of like liberal dreamers for a long time. But all of the world's organizations, like I said, every major bank, credit card company, you know, any major institution, major player is part of this. And now their major vision is to have a global reset where we redistribute the wealth and make it a more equitable world, and you know, move into this place where, you know, they're celebrating surveillance technology because they're not going to call it that, and we're going to move into a time where you know, basically we're all going to be happy because we're going to have these wonderful solutions with technology and with the way that we live and we work, and all the nations are going to get together and get along. I mean, you look up World Economic Forum, and this isn't science fiction. It's not tomorrow. It's today. Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, just talked about it the other day. And he was saying, you know, we're committed to the reset. And, you know, these are the plans that we had. But they're all very overt about, if you look all over the place, COVID-19 is a huge opportunity, they say, because it is, it's been a major global crisis. And they just say, well, you know, there's more crises to come. And these people love crisis. They love a problem because, well, in some ways, I like problem solving too, but for a different reason, because they need a problem so that they can enact their plans. Okay. Now, how this all would really play out, I don't know. And I'm not expecting it to play out tomorrow, but it is far more in the air than ever before. Okay. Than ever before. It's being talked about. It's the rumbles are there, and big tech and what has happened in these past years with big tech and now the influence it's having on society. Well, you know, COVID has helped destabilize society, and our civil and social unrest is destabilizing society, which pushes, you know, these people of power like Bloomberg, who is one of the major players in this as well, who's a billionaire, and he's talking about redistributing wealth. Is he going to give his wealth away? No. And he's talking about equity and all of these ideas where this guy spent hundreds of millions of dollars in the U.S. on Democratic races, and those Democratic leaders still lost. He has an agenda, okay? I don't trust the guy as far as I could throw him. But the point is that this is all real. And so even social destabilization and health destabilization cause there to be this cry from the leaders. Hey, we're smart. We have the solutions. We will help you. And we know that when there's enough trouble, people want security. Right now, you know, there's a real debate about COVID. You know, there are those that they want the lockdown. Others don't want the lockdown. But it just gets to a point where people say, just keep me safe. You know, like the desire humanity has is not as much for freedom. Freedom costs. Really, what we're more prone to is security. Just give me something, take care of me, and keep me safe. And as things get more and more intense, which I hope they alleviate, because these leaders terrify me, they're going to take advantage of that and say, hey, we can provide the security. We can provide the comfort that you need. And we're gonna make everything equitable. Another point, I really need to wrap it up. I'm just rambling here, but, and then this is my last one for a while, but I'll say is that you have to pay attention to their message about social justice, equity, and how much they talk about Black Lives Matter, the Me Too movement, and the same things that are causing major upheaval here in the U.S. is something that on a global scale, particularly in Britain, Australia, other countries, but the World Economic Forum has harnessed these ideas, and it is in their best interest for us to be racially divided, which is another reason why I am appalled and actually really grieved that the church is buying this, because it's the same rhetoric coming from Peter Krause, or not Peter Krause, Klaus Schwab. I'm calling Peter Krause. Sorry, Peter Krause. Schwab, from Klaus Schwab, and out of Germany, and from some of these major leaders that are from other parts of the globe, and they're exploiting race, and they're exploiting our racist colonial history, and pretending to be the saviors of civilization. And this ideology has been infiltrating for a long time. If you listen to my past podcast, going back early on, and you know, going back even to pre-World War II, but especially then after the World War, and just how long these doctrines have been mutating and crossbreeding, and finally now, here we are, and now the church is embracing these ideas and not realizing, no, we think we're just fighting for, you know, what we care about is racial reconciliation. Yeah, our good intentions are getting hijacked. They're getting hijacked and getting used. And that's exactly how powerful manipulative people work. They will manipulate your good intentions. They will manipulate your life. They will manipulate a whole society. I probably sound like a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, like Dave Rubin said the other day, the only way to not be a conspiracy theorist is just close your eyes and pretend like nothing's going on. Because everything I'm saying right now is a fact. It's not a hard to find fact. It's not a disputed fact. We know that this is what these leaders are saying. Now, the conclusions, how it's going to all play out, what the motivations are, I don't know. But like I said, I think power, especially money, is behind it. And these multi-billionaires, they don't intend to lose their money. No, they want to redistribute your wealth and my wealth. They want, meritocracy is a bad thing. The world where people work hard to get something, they talk about it, not just in critical theory here, not just in critical race theory. It's on the World Economic Forum's webpage. Meritocracy. So those people that worked hard, it was really just privilege. And that person over there that didn't work hard, we're just going to give them what you worked hard to make. There are real problems here that, you know, you could write volumes of books about. So if you have listened this long, you can tell there are a lot of things on my mind. And my appeal to you is to put your radar up. If you're a believer, pray. You know, I'm going to turn off some of the noise for a while and try to listen and pray, because we have to see through what our eyes are showing us. And I think that so much of what our eyes are seeing really is not telling us the truth. Even the things that seem to be so real. Yeah, there are racial issues, but it's the perception about it is wrong. We are in the midst of reality wars. I'm grateful. As a believer, I know that there's an objective reality that I can be anchored to, okay? Many people don't have that. Some people would question me as to whether it's really there, you know? But I absolutely believe in the Word of God. I believe in eternity. I believe that God is the great I Am, and that He's real and He's near. And He's objectively real and true. And I can anchor myself to Him. And because true, you know, Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Another way of using that word means reality. I am the way, the reality, and the life. He is reality. And so all wisdom and knowledge, the treasures of those things, are found in Him. And it behooves us to not live by what our eyes see, and to not live by lies and just what the media is telling us, and actually to question everything. And I know it's a kind of a dangerous place to be. We're all cynical and wondering, what can I trust? Who can I trust? And we should be asking that. But if you have faith, grab hold of the Lord. I know there are many that are standing, and they're standing on objective truth. They don't believe in, you know, they're not Christians. They don't believe in the Bible, but that are taking real stands, you know, that I've seen, like James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose and different ones that I really admire. And I'm grateful that they do believe that there is some kind of objective reality. So I'm going to, you know, what the heck, if you've listened this long, I'm going to end with two things. One is, I'm going to end with this. If you want to listen, this is kind of cool. It's written by Zuboff, the lady Shoshana Zuboff, that wrote Surveillance Capitalism. And at the beginning of her book, she gave this little analogy about how hard it is to foresee something that's unprecedented. Like, you know, we often think things are going to change, but we can't imagine a radical change. So like I was saying, I believe there's a massive civilization shift, and we just can't even fathom that. You know, it's like the fall of Rome, but it's almost overnight. And it's that dramatic, if not more dramatic. And so I'm just going to read this from her book real quickly. She gave a great analogy from her own life. She says, on a stormy night some years ago, our home was struck by lightning, and I learned a powerful lesson in the comprehension-defying power of the unprecedented. Within moments of the strike, thick black smoke drifted up the staircase from the lower level of the house and toward the living room. As we mobilized and called the fire department, I believed that I had just a minute or two to do something useful before rushing out to join my family. First, I ran upstairs and closed all the bedroom doors to protect them from smoke damage. Next, I tore back downstairs to the living room, where I gathered up as many of our family photo albums as I could carry and set them outside on a covered porch for safety. The smoke was just about to reach me when the fire marshal arrived to grab me by the shoulder and yank me out the door. We stood in the driving rain, where to our astonishment, we watched the house explode in flames. I learned many things from the fire, but among the most important was the unrecognizability of the unprecedented. In that early phase of crisis, I could imagine our home scarred by smoke damage, but I could not imagine its disappearance. I grasped what was happening through the lens of past experience, envisioning a distressing but ultimately manageable detour that would lead back to the status quo. Unable to distinguish the unprecedented, all I could do was to close doors to rooms that would no longer exist and seek safety on a porch that was fated to vanish. I was blind to conditions that were unprecedented in my experience. Friends, that's what I think we're facing. And I don't want to spend my time closing doors to rooms that aren't even going to be there. You know, trying to mitigate and manage damage to something that's going to completely vanish. We've got to see through the lies. We've got to see through what's going on. We've got to see through the attempts to control our speech and therefore our thoughts and really our souls. Like, there is a real crisis at hand. And at the same time, there is a real opportunity. But it's not the one that the World Economic Forum wants to bring in. If we would be awake and stand, who knows? Who knows what could happen? All right, friends. Until next time, if there is a next time, have a good one.